The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Wanna take a ride? Broadcasting from the sprawling outskirts of the Florida Everglades, in the intellectual wilderness of South Lauderdale, the outer regions of humanity that people move to just because it doesn't snow. This is the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right, we are here. Unfortunately, I don't think our audio streaming is working. I thought I had all the settings done, except my Winamp files are not working. We have a picture on YouTube. There should be a picture on YouTube. YouTube, you should be there. And we're even in sync. I had to revert to an older version of the software that I use to do away with the syncing problems, but it just gave us other problems. I don't know what to tell you. And for those in the at NicoleSandler.com listening to the audio stream, I have a feeling you're not hearing us. And for that, I am so sorry. I thought I had it fixed, but come on over, hit the YouTube button, and at least you can listen to the audio there. And I hope to have it fixed by tomorrow. Best laid plans and all that. I spent the holidays, the last week or so, working out. You have both on YouTube. Okay, you have picture and sound on YouTube. Unfortunately, to the people, you know, at NicoleSandler.com who listen on the audio stream, I am really sorry, but we don't appear to be working correctly today. I will have it fixed for tomorrow. All right, it seems the people over there know. So, all right, listen on YouTube. All right, we've got a busy show for our first day back. As usual, I want to start with a bit of comedy, but I couldn't find anything current. So I went looking for a good comedy bit that was timely and topical, but all the late night, you know, shows are off. I can't use Samantha Bee because I get copyright violated. So anyway, what I did was I started looking for some old vintage political comedy. And I found something that I want to play for you. And it goes hand in hand with, I'm also guest hosting for the broadcast today and tomorrow. So, I recorded a bunch of stuff over the holidays to prepare us for this time. And now I've got like extra stuff to air. So what's going to happen on today's broadcast is a couple of interviews. One of them, it goes back to the 60s and the early 70s. There was a book. Oh, the 24/7 player is working now? I give up. Everything's kind of foobar. Okay, if it's working, that's good. Anyway, so I got pitched on a book called What Happened to the Hippies? And it's Voices and Perspectives, and it's a bunch of essays about, you know, how things were 40, 50 years ago. And so on the broadcast today, we take a little break from politics. So you can listen to that show over there. But it got me in this mood to think about all the, you know, how things were politically back in the 60s and 70s. And so today's comedy bit takes us back to 1968. All right, I found a bit from the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, which was just an amazing show that features a very young George Carlin in probably one of his first television appearances. And the bit is titled, George Carlin Sings About the News on the Smothers Brothers. So I figured that was a good way to kick off 2020 by going back to 1968. We'll see how different things were then. Okay, here we go. Gotta hit play.
More people today are staying at home and watching their television sets instead of doing something informative and constructive like reading the newspaper. My mouth is weird.
Newspapers all across the country are George closing Carlin because they haven't any readership.
That's right. And if it wasn't for the newspapers, we'd never get all the details and we'd miss those real super-duper small human interest items that never make the television news. So tonight, we're going to back into the world of print and show you what you've been missing.
That's right.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour Daily News.
newspapers used to be such fun. Brought the news to everyone. I don't know, we read it in the Daily News. Now television's stealing all their thunder. Newspaper companies are going under. I don't know, we read it in the Daily News.
Now here's a front, Now here's a front page headline. Geologists predict California earthquake.
All right, state your business at the desk, please.
Listen, I was just driving over Route 85 up on Eagle Summit, and when I got to the California border, California was gone. Disappeared. It just dropped into the ocean.
What else?
Well, you don't understand. There's been an earthquake or something. It's all ocean. There's no more California.
What?
Listen, officer, California's gone. There's 15 million people missing.
Okay, what are their names?
Here's another front page headline. It says, President-elect Richard Nixon. Nixon is busy choosing his new cabinet. Wow.
I'd like to see President-elect Nixon, please.
I told you, Mr. Nixon is a very busy man.
I've been waiting for 4 hours.
I am terribly sorry, but you'll just have to be patient.
Look, I have to see him right now.
Mr. Nixon is in conference. He's busy selecting the members for his new cabinet. I suggest that you make an appointment.
My name is Agnew. He knows me.
Headline, Harvey Fisher motel owner claims to have talked to creatures from outer space.
Now tell me, Mr. Fisher, tell me exactly what happened.
Well, last night I was watching TV and I heard this loud whistling noise.
Whistling noise.
And all of a sudden, a ladder come down out of a big dish, and people walked right out of it, and they came over here to my desk.
Oh, what'd they look like?
Well, their heads was where our stomach is, and they had long, straight legs that didn't bend, and gigantic feet.
Well, did you call the police or notify anyone?
Oh, not right away. First thing, I registered them, and then I got kind of mad, and I did call the police.
Oh, what made you mad to call the police?
Well, they signed in as Mr. and Mrs. Gvork, and I know they weren't married.
Well, how'd you know that?
Well, the lady had a big finger right here, and there's no ring on it.
Here are some things from the sports section. Headline, American Dan Swetlock tries to break world hammer throw today. Dan Swetlock, I understand you have the world's record in the hammer throw. Now, just what is the distance of this throw?
Well, 3 weeks ago, I threw it 734 meters. It was a world record and beat my old record by 300 meters.
300 meters? That's fantastic.
That's right, it was.
Well, what do you attribute this amazing success to?
Well, total concentration and understanding of the hammer throw.
Uh-huh.
And also a unique form, which I developed myself.
Well, what is this form?
Well, it's a special form. I'll show you today, and I'll back up, because I'm only going to do it once.
Nobody's ever done this before?
No, it's my form. I'll do
it. You think you could beat your last record?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Now, here's a controversial headline. Church split on birth control.
Huh?
Father, I realize you're a very liberal priest. In fact, I understand you've just gotten married.
Yes.
But how do you feel about the Pope and birth control?
Oh, I may be married, but I'd never go against the Pope as far as birth control is concerned. Never.
Uh-huh, never. But suppose you found your wife taking the pill.
Well, I think I'd have to file for divorce.
Daily News, Daily News. Pick up the coffee anytime you choose.
This one's from the bridge section, and the headline is, Man Injured in Watts Bridge Tournament.
I'll pass.
One down.
Two clubs.
Three spades. let you ride, ride along to Never Never Land.
Poverty program, income tax, newspaper sure distort the facts. How do I know? I read it in the Daily News.
Wait a minute. What are you trying to say?
I'm saying that the newspapers distort all the facts and are corrupting the news, and you can't believe anything you read in the papers.
Sound familiar? Yeah.
How do you know that?
Yeah. I read in the papers.
Daily News, Daily Blues. Pick up a copy anytime you choose.
Okay, well, we got the echo problem fixed midway through there to you YouTubers. Thanks for sticking through that. Going back 50 years for a bit of political comedy, and wow, the more things change, the more they stay the same, huh? I guess there was problems with, you know, fake news back then as well. But people read newspapers back in 1968. We didn't have the internet. And in fact, you had your daily newspaper and you had your local television channels, maybe three to choose from, four if you were lucky. Things were different back then, weren't they? The Smothers Brothers were great. And they were very irreverent for the time. And boy, if you weren't watching on YouTube, you heard George Carlin. His voice was kind of unrecognizable, but he was not unrecognizable. He looked kind of different. All right, somebody just asked, "Where's Pat Paulson?" All right, you know what? I have another clip, and since I screwed up that first one, I'm going to play for you a Pat Paulson editorial. Now, Pat Paulson, for those of you who are too young and don't know, Pat Paulson ran for president starting in 1968. I think that was the first time. And sorry, I'm trying to rewrite the caption. I'll wait until I start playing the audio here, and then I'll fix the what's going to be on screen for you. So Pat Paulson ran a number of times as kind of, you know, a humorous candidate from the Smothers Brothers show, and then he continued it going after Smothers Brothers were canceled by CBS, which they were because they were too politically outspoken. They were too subversive, if you will. They went against the CBS censors. So anyway, Pat Paulson was, for anyone who, you know, grew up back in the 60s, remembers him as the presidential candidate. So I came up, I found this editorial he delivered as a presidential candidate in 1968, and he's delivering an editorial on a subject that is still one that we, you know, grapple with today. So because we can, and because I, you know, that was so tortured of the beginning of the show, I thought we'd start with, I'll bring you a second one. I kept this queued up just in case because I had a feeling we might need it. So take it away, an editorial from Pat Paulson.
Firearms be restricted. Once again, speaking for our program, Mr. Patrick Paulson, Vice President.
Many people today are suggesting that restrictions be placed on the purchase and ownership of firearms. No one questions that these are good, solid citizens, which combines deterrence. But they are grossly misguided patrols, or else it can be major for lunch or communists. But we respect them. And we will fight to the death against their right to express their opinions. Let us define our terms. We are merely talking about simple firearms, pistols, rifles, bazookas. So let us not depart for all sclerol. Secondly, I ask you, what is our most cherished right since pioneer days? The right for every man, woman, and child to carry a gun. It This is not a statement of creation, but has banned the meanings that even a child can understand. If you're old enough to get arrested, you're old enough to carry a gun. A gun is a necessity. Who knows, if you're walking down a street, you'll spot a moose. I feel these restrictions are plot and sporadic turn for listing. We at the Smothers Brothers program consider this personal attack on our own integrity. Personally, I myself carry a gun. Should I be restricted from carrying a gun?
Yes.
Do I look unstable?
Yes.
Let us not be led mass by those who had last met us. Let no man take away our liberties.
That's a visual. Sorry.
Stand up and be counted. Let's preserve our freedom to kill.
If you wish a copy of the preceding editorial, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to Editorial, Box 1763, Beverly Hills.
Oh.
California.
Okay, sorry. More Smothers Brothers. So there's enough for you. A little bit of Pat Paulson running for president on a no gun control platform, I suppose. All right, so we're back. Sorry for the technical problems first day out, but I kind of knew this was going to happen because, after all, you know, before the break, I was struggling with the new computer I got, which wasn't working right. I replaced it with a allegedly better, certainly more expensive computer, still having issues. So the Dell people are supposed to be calling me later this evening so we can figure that out. Anyway, that's, you know, my cross to bear. All right, so let's do this. We've got some news. It's the beginning of the year. Congress is still out, so there's not a whole lot of news going on. But there's some. Let's see if this will work. No, this whole board that I set up is not working. So I'll just, without the sounder. I read the news today. Oh, boy. So here we go. I wanted to play for you. Did I put it over here? I got this. It's 2020.
And I'm Barbara Walters, and this is 2020.
2020.
All of us here at 2020 have a safe and enjoyable weekend. Good night.
All right. So 2020, we're here. I know, big buildup for not very much. Anyway, the Senate's impeachment trial plans are still up in the air. It's 32 days until the Iowa caucuses. 33 days until Trump's State of the Union address, and 40 days until the New Hampshire primary. There was some breaking news this morning. New unredacted emails and other documents from officials at the Department of Defense and the Office of Management and Budget were just reported on by the website justsecurity.org. And these documents were released as part of a FOIA request, but they were heavily redacted. Well, Just Security got a hold of the unredacted documents, and they released some of them in an article at justsecurity.org. I'll link to it from the blog at nicolesandler.com, where I post the podcast after the show today. But they clearly show that Michael Duffy, the Associate Director of National Security Programs at the Office of Management and Budget, told Elaine McCusker, who is the acting Pentagon Comptroller, in an August 30th email, quote, clear direction from POTUS to continue to hold. August 30th, more than a month after the July 25th phone call, and 2 weeks about before the September 11th revelations of the whistleblower report, after which Trump, you know, all of a sudden released the funds. But on August 30th, an email, unredacted, clearly shows the directive coming from the Office of Management and Budget, quote, clear direction from POTUS to continue to hold. It's now, again, only been made available in redacted form until now. It's one of many documents that the Trump administration is trying to keep from the public, despite congressional oversight efforts and court orders and Freedom of Information Act litigation. So we're going to hear more of this, but already Chuck Schumer is coming out and saying, this just underscores the need for witnesses to testify in a Senate impeachment trial. So there you go. There was a mess at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad over the last couple of days. U.S. troops fired tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters yesterday for a second time. The protests by hundreds of supporters of an Iranian-backed militia began on Tuesday when they broke through a gate and set fire to a reception area as U.S. diplomats were barricaded inside the embassy. But late yesterday, the militia fighters finally retreated across the Tigris River after all these clashes. The conflict began after American airstrikes on Sunday killed 25 fighters of this Iran-backed militia in Iraq. The Trump administration said those U.S. strikes were in retaliation for last week's killing of an American contractor and the wounding of American and Iraqi troops in a rocket attack on an Iraqi military base that the U.S. blamed on the militia. It's a mess, as is anything that Trump gets near. It's just the whole thing is ever more frightening because Donald Trump is calling the shots. And that should make you terrified. Meanwhile, something else we should be terrified about is North Korea, where Kim Jong-un said yesterday that his country would continue building its nuclear arsenal and would soon unveil a new strategic weapon. Yeah. Kim's comments came after his deadline passed for the U.S. to begin new talks on exchanging denuclearization progress and sanctions relief. He had warned that he might take a new path if the U.S. ignored his ultimatum. And obviously, the U.S. ignored his ultimatum. Mike Pompeo said, you know, he's hopeful that they'll, you know, work things out. Donald Trump says, we love each other. We love each other. We fell in love. And but John Bolton, the former national security advisor, who's been very critical of Trump's stance, not only on North Korea, but certainly on North Korea, tweeted yesterday that the U.S. should resume military exercises with South Korea. You think? And they never should have stopped. Donald Trump was had by Kim Jong-un. He also said that the U.S. should hold hearings to determine U.S. troop readiness on the Korean Peninsula in the wake of Kim's assertion that he can violate a ban on testing nuclear weapons. Lovely. Campaigns are rolling out their 2019 fourth quarter fundraising numbers, and once again, Bernie Sanders blows them all away. Bernie pulled in a record $34.5 million in the fourth quarter, with an average donation of $18.53, bringing his 2019 total to more than $96 million from over 5 million individual donations, breaking all kinds of records. In 2016, he didn't reach 5 million until after Super Tuesday. Candidates have until January 31st to release their quarter four numbers, but they're starting to roll out. Pete Buttigieg reported a pretty huge haul himself of $24.7 million, they say with an average contribution of $33. By the way, after 8 years as mayor of South Bend, Indiana, which is not a city, it's a town. I'm sorry. Pete Buttigieg carried out his last official act as mayor yesterday on New Year's Day. He was just 29 when he was elected mayor of the population 100,000 town. But he's now no longer Mayo. Well, he's still Mayo. He's just not mayor. So Pete took in 24.7. Joe Biden's campaign just released his numbers, $22.7 million. Better than he's performed so far in this race. But what does it say that Mayo Pete outraised him? Andrew Yang's campaign announced they've raised $16.5 million in the last 3 months. Elizabeth Warren hasn't released her numbers yet, but we know she's raised at least $17 million because that's where she was at last week, when her campaign started sending out these SOS signals that they needed more money, that they were not close to where they were last time. So she'll be in the neighborhood. And Tulsi Gabbard released her numbers. She's got $3.4 million raised in quarter four. The rest are coming in. Now, all that happened, and, well, I guess somebody's numbers were not good. I'm sure, you know, maybe a few more we'll hear from. But Julian Castro has officially ended his quest for the presidency. It's okay. He was always running for vice president anyway. Just saying. What else do I want to tell? We're going to get John Nichols on the phone in a moment. So let me just read you this one last story. The first day of 2020, that was yesterday, it marked a bevy of new legislation, including statewide legalization of recreational marijuana in Illinois. And an interesting aside, the state's lieutenant governor was one of the first people in line to buy legal weed, as it should be, I suppose. And the day before the law went into effect, Illinois' governor, J.B. Pritzker, granted more than 11,000 pardons for low-level marijuana convictions. That makes me happy. You know, light one up in celebration. I'll wait till after the show. In other states around the country, 21 states and 26 cities and counties raised their minimum wage. That's good. Sadly, still not enough, but it's at least step in the right direction. Several more jurisdictions will raise their minimum wage later this year. Colorado's red flag gun law is now in effect, which allows family and other authorized parties to petition to temporarily remove firearms from someone deemed a danger to themselves or others. Tennessee, though, is moving in the wrong direction. They have new regulations making it easier for residents to get a concealed carry permit. Go figure. And texting and driving is now officially illegal in Florida. Thank you very much. And plastic bag bans have started in Oregon and Albuquerque, or as I call it, Albuquerque. So that's just some of what's going on. Again, things are going to pick up next week. We're still in sort of a, you know, a lull period. A lot of people, including the House of Representatives, don't return until next week. Now, tomorrow, allegedly, that the Senate is back in session, but they don't have any votes until next week. So I think it's just going to be a sort of official ceremonial gaveling in to start the new the second half of this session of Congress. That brings us to today. And I'm going to get our guest on the line. You know him, you love him, John Nichols of The Nation. He is what is his title even? I think he's the Washington, let me get this straight. this is John Nichols' phone. I forgot he's got this kind of weird phone thing.
Hello?
Hey, John Nichols, it's Nicole Sandler calling.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am fine.
Good. I got something funky going on with my, I got a new computer over the holidays. I set it up, which is always a dangerous thing to do. And then the first day back, nothing is as it's supposed to be. So anyway, we're fine. Just the picture looks funky of me on YouTube, but that's all right. So John Nichols of The Nation, we've got sort of a tradition going here. You've been for many years running the a progressive honor roll over at The Nation. At the end of every year, you sort of look back on the year and decide, hand out some awards, as it were. They're not actual physical awards, but awards nonetheless, for some of the great progressive work that's been done in the year past. And I noticed it's sort of a different list this year than in years past.
I think it is a little bit. I'm interested in what you've noticed. So you say what you're thinking. And we'll,
okay. All right. Well, first off, the first thing I noticed is Bernie Sanders is not on the list. Now, I think he wasn't there last year, too, because he was sort of, you know, he always won the most progressive senator award. It was like a standing thing. So I think he finally had to say he's the honorary progressive champion and we're going to share the power and spread it around a little bit.
Your understanding is a very good one. And, you know, this is the interesting dynamic of it. And one of the things that we try to do is, of course, to recognize, you know, those folks have been around for a long time and do good things. It's all, and that there are always points where we should do that. And, mm-hmm. and we have over the years many times. But you also want to point attention in other directions and to help people to see that there are other figures who may have been around for a long time, but not as noticed, and also newcomers, frankly, mm-hmm. who are doing a lot of big, bold, and interesting things. And as we say in the intro, in this case, two of the longtime sort of heroes of the list, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who frequently have come up in top spots, are both running for president.
Massachusetts is very well represented in this year's honor roll. You have the Green New Deal senator who you salute, and it's Ed Markey. Ed Markey is sort of he's the low key guy that you don't hear much about. So it's nice that you're shining a spotlight on him.
Well, it is, and also, you know, one of the important things to understand is that, you know, if Ed Markey was running for president, and he's not, I don't think he's considered it, he'd be running right there with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. He'd be running as a very, very progressive candidate. But instead, he has focused his energy as a longtime legislator, somebody who's been long time in the House and more recently in the Senate, on, you know, amplifying the messages, especially that young, new members of Congress are bringing forward. And so it's notable that Ed Markey has aligned with Congressman Liu from California, Ted Liu, on issues of nuclear weapons use and basically putting forward no first strike legislation, saying the United States wouldn't initiate a nuclear war, certainly without congressional approval, but really in the deeper sense, just not do it. And this is important stuff. I mean, it certainly relates to Donald Trump, but more broadly, it relates to the too infrequently discussed issue of nuclear war and the threat that is always there.
Right.
He also has worked very, very closely with a number of younger members on the issue of net neutrality. He's been really kind of the prime Senate member focusing on trying to renew and restore and advance net neutrality, which is sort of a central premise of this digital age. And then finally, most notably, he has been Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's chief ally in the Senate.
That's right.
On the Green New Deal.
Right,
and
which is great.
You'd be surprised how many decent Democratic senators have not fully embraced Green New Deal thinking, but he has. And Ocasio-Cortez and Markey have worked very, very well on this issue.
And yet, Joe Kennedy is primarying him? Is he following through on that? Is that really happening?
Looks to be the case. And that is it's a reality. We, of course,
wow.
I always accept primaries. I think that they're appropriate.
I think
so too. And it's, you may not always like who's running against who, but folks have a right to do it. And so I'm not going to criticize Mr. Kennedy for potentially or likely making this run. But what I will say is that before you toss out a sitting senator, you got to ask, you know, are they useful? Mm-hmm. Is that senator doing some good? And in this case, I would argue that there's an awful lot of evidence that Ed Markey has been a very, very useful senator.
I agree. And he was a good member of the House before that. He's a good, nose to the grindstone kind of guy who gets stuff done. And he's a progressive, which is what we need more of. I mean, go and primary Joe Manchin, primary Kyrsten Sinema. You know, there's plenty of them that you can that I feel good about. But
that would require a move across state law.
Right. I understand that. I was saying it, you know, sort of just generally someone should from the left. The next category, having something that's different this year, that you never hold the same categories from year to year. You basically salute a senator and a member of Congress and a local state official and, you know, local officials. You use a lot of different categories. The member of Congress that you spotlight this year as the Think Big representative is Ayanna Pressley. I mentioned Massachusetts was very well represented.
Yeah.
Ayanna Pressley is from Massachusetts as well.
And it wasn't our intent necessarily to, you know, be nice to Massachusetts, although there's no reason not to.
Right.
But in this case, it's interesting because Ayanna Pressley is a part of the squad.
Mm-hmm.
And those four members of the House, along with, frankly, a couple of other recently elected members, have just done so much important work. And it would be easy to pick any of a number of people. In recent years, we've recognized Pramila Jayapal and Ro Khanna. Last year, we recognized the whole squad, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and Ayanna Pressley.
Right.
We wanted this year to look at Ayanna Pressley for a reason, and that is that while it's certainly true, and there's great honor to be paid AOC for highlighting the Green New Deal and a host of other issues. Now, we were struck by the fact that Ayanna Pressley has taken on some really bold things and some things that don't get as much attention. And it doesn't make her necessarily, certainly not the only bold member, but it's pretty fascinating. And one of the things that really frankly stood out is the fact that she is an advocate for lowering the voting age to 16.
Right.
And in a really big issue of this. And when we talk about great big structural change, you know, fundamental changes, lowering the voting age to 16 is an appropriate thing to do. Teenagers have been in the lead on climate change and all sorts of racial justice, LGBTQ issues. So there's every reason to say that these leaders should be a part of the political process. But also, just a practical reality, these are progressives. If you look at the polling data, younger voters tend to be very, very progressive. They tend very much to be sympathetic to Bernie Sanders in the presidential level, but they also tend to be very sympathetic to progressive candidates in general, and even, you know, to a lesser extent, you know, the Democratic Party. And why this is significant is that, you know, when you get your voting rights at the age of 18, you may already be out of high school, you may already be, you know, into college or wherever, or working. And there's not much as much structural introduction to democracy, but if you give voting rights at 16, then most of these young people are still in high school.
Right.
And it's a fabulous way to encourage them to participate in the process, literally open the polling place at their school and invite them into the process there, show them how to do it. It's a natural reform. And by the way, it's a reform that has getting traction all over the world.
Really?
There's a number of countries that lowered the voting age to 16. And there are also voting jurisdictions in the United States that have done so, including some communities around Washington, D.C. and some of the Maryland suburbs.
Hmm.
So there's something happening here. And that's, you know, like at the core, that's one of the real reasons that we highlighted Ayanna Pressley, because we think, you know, taking these big, bold structural changes that really could fundamentally alter how democracy operates and bringing them into the process, pushing them as she has in a number of venues, pretty good deal.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good point that, I mean, the last couple of years, certainly where I'm at, we're seeing the activism of young people. You know, I live in the town of Coral Springs, Florida. We're right next door to Parkland. It's our sister city. So we've seen the young people, you know, really step up and take control. And those kids, many of whom graduated last year, David Hogg and I'm blanking on names, Jacqueline, whatever her last name is. And many of them took a year off to be activists, to travel, to learn more about our political system. They're so involved, and they got other kids involved. They are the future, and I'm seeing, thankfully, young people being more plugged in, more so than their predecessors of, say, 10 years ago, who you know, frankly, were pretty apathetic because young people historically don't vote. I think we're going to see a difference in this election. Please correct me if you think differently, but I think the numbers of young people, the 18-year-old vote, I think is going to be, I think the turnout will surprise us.
I hope you're right, and I do think that, in part, that's a responsibility of the Democratic Party, right?
Yep.
You know, one of the things that I always think is important is that when you're having a discussion about bringing young people into the process, one thing is to be sort of hectoring and say, well, why aren't you doing this? Why don't you step up, right? And that's not a very effective way to invite anybody into any process.
Mm-mm.
The better way is to give them a reason to do it, right? A, make it easy, but B, give them a reason. And that does involve, you know, the choice of your nominee for president.
That's right.
And your choice of your nominees for other offices. There are simply some candidates who excite young voters at a much higher level than others. And frankly, party strategists and others ought to make that a part of their mix when they think about, you know, who would be a good candidate.
Mm-hmm. I fully agree. I worry still. Look, I don't want to relitigate 2016, but I do worry about the Democratic Party. There's already talk that there could be a brokered convention. And obviously, the superdelegates are less of a factor this time out. They don't get to vote in a first round of voting. But if there's a second round, then it goes back to business as usual in the Democratic Party. And I don't think that's a good thing.
It's a terrible thing. And frankly, if you ended up coming out of the convention with a sense that that the popular will had been denied or undermined, it's devastating. I think it would probably be, you know, I'm always cautious about, you know, predicting too much of the future because you never know what might come into play. But frankly, any sense that the will of the base of the party was undermined by party elites would be very beneficial to Donald Trump.
Yeah,
I think
I agree.
Not because people would switch over and vote for Trump, and I don't
know because they'll stay home.
That's the fear. Yeah, just that mobilization becomes more difficult.
Exactly. In the Progressive Honor Roll at the Nation, we're speaking with John Nichols, who puts this together every year. You spotlight some local legislators and activists. I love that you. You know, you talk about the prosecutors, progressive prosecutors, and you name the new ones in Chicago and Philadelphia. And I don't, where's Rachel Rollins from? I don't know.
She's up in the Boston area.
Oh, okay. So you spotlight three new prosecutors who are progressive. And then in the next one, you have new style judge Franklin Bynum. And he wrote, changing the criminal justice system requires more than a different kind of DA. It also requires new judges like Franklin Bynum, who you note was elected to the Harris County Criminal Court bench in Houston. And that's good. I always had a weird feeling about elected judges. But after seeing what Donald Trump and this administration is doing to the federal bench, I have more of a problem with appointed judges because he's changed the face of our judicial system for a generation already.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And look, the progressives of a century ago had no fetishism of the courts. They expected the courts, as they were structured, to be more conservative, right? Mm-hmm. And that the courts would be barriers to progressive change. And so they generally tended to be in favor of an elected judiciary as well as the ability to hold the judiciary to account via recalls and impeachment and other vehicles. And we got away from that because the courts in the 1950s and 1960s, especially at the federal level, really were in the forefront of civil rights and voting rights and women's rights.
Yeah.
And so for a time there was a sense, wow, you know, this court's the way they work. It kind of works in a way that's decent. Maybe even it allows society to address an issue that might be tense, that might be a little bit challenging, without having it get bogged down in politics. But I would argue that was always an anomalous situation, right? You had a certain bench that had developed. You had certain times. In the overall scheme of things, my sense is that an elected judiciary remains, in a lot of senses, an appealing reality. Now, it's hard because of money and politics, right? Mm-hmm. And in many places, the elected judiciary is warped by the inflow of corporate cash, things like that. But at the local level, you can still elect judges, reasonably, affordably, if you will. And Frank Bynum, as well as a number of other judges who've been elected down in Texas, really points to, this, why there's value in this. Because in Dallas, Houston, some other areas, you're seeing newly elected judges push for radical reform. And I don't mean radical, and I don't want to scare anybody, but, it's fundamental. The term radical is a wonderful term. It's a beautiful term. It means that you address the root causes of things. You really try to address that which must be dealt with. And in criminal justice reform, we need that. And what Frank Bynum's been doing down in Texas is to say, look, I don't understand why we have cash bail. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why, you put somebody got a minor infraction and then you put them in jail because they don't have enough money to, they'll basically file their paperwork and signal that they'll stick around for, when they have to be tried. And they have really begun to undo in a fundamental way the cash bail system and a lot of other structures of the criminal justice system down there.
Good.
In really smart ways. Yeah.
Well, that's encouraging. I mean, it's great to hear good news about our judicial system, because it's what the Trump administration is doing is chilling. It's frightening. And I worry for the it's times like this. I'm happy that I'm old. I mean, I'm not going to be around that much longer, but my kid will be. And, you know, all these other kids will be. So the future is. I have worries about what's the direction the country is going. And certainly if Trump has the opportunity to name another justice to the Supreme Court, I mourn for the future of this nation. It's just frightening.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right to worry. And, but like, as I said, we're seeing around the country in these prosecutors and in some of these judges, evidence that you can, even in this era, even in the Trump era, you can make big changes. And here's the fascinating part about it. What I'm hearing more and more as I talk to and cover these new prosecutors, new judges, is that when they put these ideas forward, maybe there's a little fight initially, but then quite often they get a buy-in from conservative Republicans,
mm-hmm.
Who are like, well, gosh, that saves us money and it works better.
Okay.
And so, amazingly enough, it's not always true, but on criminal justice reform, there's actually a lot of space in which to build the kinds of coalitions that unfortunately are hard to build in other areas.
Hmm. Okay. There's so much going on. One other thing, you mentioned Ed Markey, and you named him the Green New Deal Senator. Green New Deal Senator. Scrolling mm-hmm. down a bit, you go to... changing the political climate, interesting use of words, and the Sunrise Movement, who again is a group of young people who really upped the ante on discussions and action on climate change.
That's right. And I mean, what they're doing is just incredibly encouraging, mm-hmm. at least to my view. And that is that they are really challenging politicians and the political process. And it's exciting that they're pushing politicians to embrace Green New Deal thinking and climate crisis responses that are needed. But they're also doing something else. They're saying, to the Democratic National Committee, for instance, hey, you have to let us have a debate on mm-hmm. climate. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to open this thing up so that you don't have the regular standard debate with one question three quarters of the way in, where two candidates are asked a little bit about, global warming, and then you're on to the next issue.
Yep.
You should have a whole debate on this existential crisis.
Without a doubt.
They have not fully succeeded, but in their pressure on the DNC, is very little question that they had a real influence in getting CNN and MSNBC to have special forums on climate. And there's a lot of debates ahead. They haven't given up. They might yet force the DNC to have a climate debate. And to my mind, I think two things would happen. Number one, we got some really valid issues discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, I suspect a climate debate would get better viewership and better attention than just the standard run through the issues.
Very possibly. Very possibly. The Progressive Honor Roll is in up at thenation.com. I will put a link to it from my blog at NicoleSandler.com, so you can read the whole thing. There's a lot of categories. It's a smaller, it seemed to be. It's a shorter list this year than in years past. But you cover a lot of ground. There's a next big idea, universal family care, multimedia news, rising up with Sonali, resilient music. Layla McCall is the Capitalist Blues. I'm not familiar with her, and I'm a music person, so I'm going to
really
have to check
good.
Her out.
Yeah.
And Think Again book, Sekou Metta's This Land Is Our Land, An Immigrant's Manifesto. Okay.
Really lovely book and beautifully written.
Cool.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I like best about doing the list is making these very small interventions to encourage people to look at a book, listen to some music that is important, that has real message to it. But also, frankly, you know, as we live our lives, we can't just think about politics all the time. Mm-hmm. We hopefully extend a little beyond it.
Exactly. And I say that all the time as I've been pushing. My escape these days is I started volunteering this year at the local animal shelter. And I go every weekend. Uh-huh. I walk dogs and I play with them. And the most important part is I help match up people who are coming to adopt with the right dog for them. And when I see a dog leave the shelter with a new family, it's the best feeling ever. Plus, it gets my mind out of politics for a few hours every Sunday. And it you know, I'm giving back to the community. It's so important that we do other things. So that's sort of my resolution this year, is to get out of this mind space more often, because this is unhealthy to be mired in this all the time, especially when it's, you know, you're thinking about Donald Trump and what he's done to the country. So, John Nichols, for the last few minutes, I wanted to talk to you about your last piece. Your newest post up at thenation.com is the headline reads, AOC tells Democrats how to get it right in 2020. And this is a trend for you. This is an ongoing topic for you, as it is for me as well. This meme that's being promoted by the corporate media, that the only way to win in 2020 is with who they call a moderate, what I more accurately call the conservadem. They're pushing Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg like they're the sorry for the term, great white hope that's going to, you know, all of a sudden beat Donald Trump, going against what the crowds are telling us, what the enthusiasm is telling us, what the fundraising is telling us. I have arguments with people all the time on Facebook and Twitter who's like, oh, we need somebody who can appeal to the Republicans. No Democrat that I would want to vote for, sorry, is going to appeal to the Republicans. And frankly, if the Republicans had done their job, they never would have let Donald Trump become president. What I'm about is finding somebody who's going to make positive change in this country. And in my mind, that means moving in a more progressive direction. I think AOC has it right. I think Ayanna Pressley has it right. I think Bernie Sanders has it right. And the fact that 14,000 people show up in Venice Beach to see Bernie and AOC and the LA Times doesn't cover it, that's a big deal. The fact that the corporate media from MSNBC to CNN has really this Bernie blackout, and it was like a revelation last week that Politico wrote, you know, Bernie Sanders is kind of, he's not going anywhere. You may have to really consider him as a contender, and it's like they all freaked out. We've been saying it all along.
Yeah, well, I think it's a twofold thing here that's going on that's kind of fascinating. Number one, there clearly has been a bias in major media against Bernie Sanders.
Yep.
It's gotten to the level of absurdity, and frankly been pretty well pointed out, especially by a lot of younger media critics who, you know, frankly have come at this with an appropriate level of anger and disdain. The folks at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting have done some tremendous work in this area.
Mm-hmm.
But with that said, there's also the reality that Bernie Sanders is having kind of a moment right now.
Yeah,
and so after a great deal of neglect, he is starting to get some attention, I think for a reason that's not much discussed. And that is, he's doing so well right now in fundraising, in polls, in, you know, at just general evidence of a solid campaign, that I think there are folks in media outlets that have tended to neglect him in the past that now feel like they better cover him because otherwise they're going to get caught flat-footed, that he is going to do very well, and their you know, pundit credentials will be called into question for not having noticed it.
That's right.
But I do think they're playing a little bit of catch-up right now.
I think so, too. My husband came home the other day with a picture on his phone that he took. He saw a car with a bumper sticker that said, Bernie Sanders, hindsight 2020.
I'm hearing that all over the place. Uh-huh. It's very funny you put that out. I think that's sort of come into play with the change of the year that a number of people have started talking about it. And this is an important thing to understand. We are at a critical pivot point where the presidential race starts to become pretty serious. We still have impeachment in play, and that's a complexity because there is a chance that impeachment will, when it does move to the Senate, and it will, where it will take the spotlight for a time.
Sure.
But with the refocusing on the presidential race, it's been very, very interesting. We have a dynamic right now in the United States where two progressive candidates, one a Democratic socialist in Bernie Sanders, two Elizabeth Warren, a progressive capitalist, who I think that phrase should be understood in the context of FDR, who would have identified as something similar to that.
Sure.
You have two candidates who are running for the presidency right now who are pushing a lot of limits and opening up a lot of ideas and debates and possibilities. And, Sanders, I think, has a little bit more of an advantage at this point than Warren. But both of them are important. Both of them are in play. And both of them are in the, you know, basically the top four, along with Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden.
Yep.
Going into the early states, it's kind of an amazing, it's a pretty big deal.
It really is. I still hold out the fantasy that whoever is leading, you know, say after Super Tuesday, and just the way it's going, it's looking like it's Bernie, that Elizabeth Warren will say, Bernie, you're it. I'm throwing my support to you. And that she will be his running mate. I know it's a fantasy, but in a perfect world, that would be it.
So, hey, you know what? We are in such an age of kind of new and unexpected politics where limits are pushed and things that you didn't think possible happen, that I keep saying to people, don't rule that out.
No.
Don't rule out the prospect that something like that might happen. Whether Warren gets out, whether Sanders did, and something, you know, whatever the scenario, that you might have a truly progressive ticket. And you know why? One answer to that is, look at it from another perspective. Pause and just say, who would be a logical running mate for Bernie Sanders?
Yeah.
If he's the nominee. And the answer is that you would want someone who has structural skills, who's, you know, been around a lot of the issues, probably served, you know, at least either as a governor or a senator or in some level of, you know, reasonable capacity of power. And, you know, as you start to do your process of elimination, Warren actually moves up that list pretty quickly.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I agree. And of course, the traditional politics as usual, people will say, well, they're both from the Northeast. They're New England. You can't do that. They're both too liberal. This is the time for non-traditional politics. Look, who in their right mind ever thought Donald Trump would ever get elected? Even though he didn't win the popular vote, he did win the Electoral College. And people are looking for something different. I think that's the reason that Pete Buttigieg is rising in the poll, because he's not politics as usual. I think politics as usual, in other words, Joe Biden, is the last thing people in this electorate want in 2020. But that's just me.
Well, I think your point is well taken. I don't know about whether Biden's the last thing people want.
Well, Trump is the last thing we want.
Yeah, maybe he's last. But also, look, I'll be honest with you. And I think that we are in a very unstable moment. And all of these candidates have possibilities for defining themselves. Sanders is very well defined and very well understood.
Oh, yes.
And I think it's worked well for him. I think he's benefited by that. Biden, I think, tends to be far more vague. Buttigieg, you know, I think he's really stumbled quite a bit in the last month or so. And Warren, frankly, who got to a frontrunner status in September, has clearly had some stumbles. But, you know, we're really at the point now where this race starts to get serious. And I don't rule out the possibility at all that Elizabeth Warren could have a electric moment where, you know, she rises very quickly and does very, very well. I do not rule out the prospect that Biden, whether you like him or not, could score wins in some of these early races.
He could.
You know, and I hate to tell you, I believe enough. I'm a critic of it, but I believe enough in the power of money in politics that we might even have to be mentioning Mr. Bloomberg at some point.
Oh, God. And Tom Steyer, who, by the way, was on the show last week. I had 10 minutes with him, and I gave it my best shot. It's like I pitched him on, take that $100 million you want to blow on this quixotic ego trip and fund a progressive media center. That's where, buy Fox News, do something, because we have no voice in the corporate mainstream media, and that's a real problem. So he wasn't listening to me. He heard what I said. Sure, he just wasn't
listening.
I'm sure
listening. He nodded.
Oh,
nodded
yeah.
Appreciative.
I'm sure he did. Yeah.
Look, you know, everybody can run for president.
Mm-hmm.
It's that, you know, if you got the basic qualifications. And, you know, with Steyer, it's kind of a bizarre situation where he now is the lesser billionaire in the
yes,
race.
Right.
What a lousy place to be.
Oh, my God.
I happen to think he's a better billionaire
mm-hmm.
than
Oh,
Bloomberg.
Yeah. If I had to choose between the two, I'd take Steyer. But still, it doesn't make me want him as president.
Well, and just be that as it may, you know, it's just the reality that it's very, very hard to see at this point the route out for him.
Yeah.
And so it does become a question. If you've got a campaign that is largely being driven by your willingness and ability to spend massive amounts of money, at what point do you say, as somebody who I think I've interviewed Steyer, I think he's a sincerely progressive
mm-hmm.
guy,
yeah.
If that you just simply say, hey, you know what? I could spend another $100 million, $200 million easily. Or I could say, this probably isn't going to work, but boy, I could see where that money could be well spent.
Yes.
You know, what yeah. my alternatives are.
Right. And more than happy to suggest again.
I know you're right in the front line there.
Yes, absolutely. John Nichols, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. I'm honored to have you as my first guest in this new year. Hoping the 2020, it can't get much worse than the last few. So keeping my fingers crossed that this turns out to be a great one. Thank you for helping us kick it off. Always appreciate your work at The Nation. Love the honor roll and really love talking with you. Thank you so much.
It's such a pleasure and such an honor and a great way to start the year. And
yeah.
by the way, it is going to be a great year.
Good.
It's going to be better than any of us expected.
Awesome. I like that attitude. I'll run with that one. John Nichols. Of The Nation. Thank you again. Have a very, very happy new year, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much. Take good care.
You too. Bye-bye. All right. John Nichols is great. I love talking to him. I can talk for hours, and how cool. Sorry for the technical problems in the middle of that. He's a trooper. Very cool of him to stick around until we got it straightened out. All right. I got to run because I'm also filling in for Brad Friedman on the broadcast today, so I got to get that show put together. I got to get this one now edited so it runs on Progressive Voices at 5. If Progressive Voices stays up, if in case you don't know what happened over the last week or so, Progressive Voices Network got hit with a cyber bug, a cyber attack of some sort, and so that's why they were off the air. I had best of shows ready to go, thinking that those would run while I was gone. yeah, nothing ran. So I did this great year-end show. So I hope you get the podcast of the New Year's Eve show. It was a year-end review because I was able to get my files back. All the files I lost, I was able to recover. And I thought now that I got them back, I should do an end-of-the-year retrospective, which took me forever. Then Progressive Voices was down for on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, so I didn't even get that to air. I've been beating my head against the wall. So I apologize for the technical issues today. I'm still working on it. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for bearing with me. Best wishes to all of us for, as John Nichols said, a great new year.